He had a Master's of Theology from Westminster Theological Seminary and a Bachelor of Arts in Philosophy from Westmont College, where he graduated with honors. He's a current scholar in residence at the University of Southern California Center for Christian Studies. It's a mouthful. He's the author of 5 books with specializations in ethics and practice, theory and knowledge, and apologetics. He's also a member of the American Philosophical Society, the Society of Christian Philosophers, Evangelical Philosophical Society, the Evangelical, and the Evangelical Theological Society, Philosophy Societies, and he's a veteran of numerous debates. So please welcome with me Dr. Greg Bonson.
Discussing a topic which often engages people in their reflection and their dialogue with each other. There's a lot of interest in this kind of thing. And I hope what I have to say gives you something to think about, to chew on, and that you'll profit from having been here. I do appreciate the invitation of the Truth Seekers to not only have me debate last evening, but also to lead you in this group discussion tonight. And I hope that it won't be the last time I see you. I'm here to speak to you tonight on the question, does ethics depend upon God? Let me clarify at the very outset. Already I'm going to get my chain yanked. I didn't even say anything. Is this working better now?
No.
Okay. How about this? Can you hear that better? I want to clarify at the outset a couple of things about this question, does ethics depend upon God? Because the question can be taken in a lot of different ways. First of all, the issue before us tonight, be very clear about this, the issue before us is not whether atheists as persons are able to live morally commendable lives. That's not what I've come to talk about tonight. Whether atheists can live morally commendable lives. Surely, many atheists, outwardly anyway, if nothing else, surely many atheists are honest people, courageous people. Many atheists love their children, take good care of their kids, and so forth. I'm not here tonight to talk about that whatsoever. Secondly, nor is the issue whether atheists engage intelligently in ethical discussion, reasoning, and issues. Again, I'm not going to at all be disputing that atheists engage in ethical discussion and try to be rational about it. And they talk intelligently about ethics and get involved in ethical issues. Atheists do, at least many atheists, do not repudiate such matters as nonsense. I realize that some atheists think that all ethics is nonsense, but that isn't true of all atheists, and I'm not here to make any sort of claim that every atheist repudiates ethics. That's just not true. Rather, I'm here tonight to ask, is the atheist theory, that is, his philosophy of reality, his philosophy of knowledge, is the atheist theory rationally consistent with ethics as an inquiry, discipline, or practice? Is atheism as a theory rationally consistent with ethics? Does ethics comport with the atheist presuppositions or the atheist worldview? And I'd like to throw out for philosophical consideration an open, polite discussion tonight, the challenging thesis that atheism cannot make what we all commonly accept and pursue as ethics intelligible. That atheism cannot make ethics intelligible. Atheism leaves our most uncontroversial judgments of morality senseless, arbitrary, and inexplicable. I'm going to give you an example here of what I trust will be a non-controversial statement of morality. I've never known anyone to disagree with it. Maybe somebody else tonight will show me otherwise. But I wanted to take a specimen, you know. We're here in a chemistry lab, so we're going to do this scientifically. I wanted to take a specimen of ethics that I don't think anybody should have any reason to think is prejudicial. I think all schools of thought, all decent people would agree with this. And then we'll use that as we come to the end of our lecture tonight. I want you to imagine this statement being made to a Somali warlord's soldier. Okay? You have the situation. We're in Somalia. And you know there's different factions, warlords, that are at each other's throats, and they have actually been pillaging food and goods from everybody else and so forth. It's a sad situation. Okay, so here's a soldier for one of these warlords, and I could imagine any decent person making this remark to the soldier. It is immoral for you to torture this child so as to extort her parents' precious little food. Okay? It is immoral for this soldier to torture a child in order to extort the parents to give up what food they have to the warlord's command. And what I'm suggesting is that atheism leaves even the most uncontroversial judgments of morality senseless, arbitrary, and inexplicable. Especially inexplicable. We'll come back to that. We're not going to be talking tonight about, I mean, I know abortion, homosexuality, all sorts of things, capital punishment, whatever it may be, you know, might bring out, in terms of the issue itself, disagreement between us. But we'll try to focus on our pure specimen. I think everybody would say it's wrong to torture children to extort, you know, the little food that the parents have so they can survive. Take that as our example. And so, in showing this, if I'm able to do so tonight, I'll be trying to demonstrate that ethics does depend upon God. We cannot, upon thorough analysis, give an account of ethics without recourse to God. And so, although I grant that atheists can be morally commendable in things that they do, and I've already granted that they engage intelligently in ethical discussion, I would in the end have to say that for all of that, they are either short-sighted or shallow in their final analysis, and unwittingly self-contradictory when they engage in ethics. Any theory like atheism, which upon deep analysis renders the statement, it is immoral for you to torture this child to extort food from her parents. Any theory which upon the deepest analysis renders that statement absurd is itself absurd, too absurd to adopt. And that's basically what I'm going to put out there for us to kick around tonight. That atheism actually renders moral statements absurd on the deepest analysis. So my agenda is going to be twofold. First, I'm going to ask, what could the atheist mean by moral terms like good and evil? And by what standard could he determine what counts as good or evil? That is, what could the atheist mean, and by what standard would he find out what counts? And then secondly, tonight I'm going to ask, what are the presuppositions in terms of which the atheist makes any moral judgments whatsoever? So let's begin with number one. What could the atheist mean by moral terms? I'm going to real quickly go through the theories that I've listed on the board here. There are more. If you were in a semester course in ethics, we would take a lot more time and look at our schools. But these are the key ones. I don't think we're being selective or avoiding the really tough ones here. Perhaps the atheist takes the word good to be whatever evokes public approval, what we call societal subjectivism. That is, when we use the word good, I say, helping orphans is good. That means helping orphans elicits or evokes the approval of society. But you see, the problem is that on that basis, if that's what you think the word good means, evokes public approval, then a statement like the one I'm going to give you could never make sense, a statement like this. The vast majority of that community hardly approved and joined in the genocide. And you read that sort of thing about the Third Reich in Hitler's Germany, for instance. You know, the whole community participated and gave approval to the genocide. Well, but don't you see, if ethical terms are defined by societal approval, it would never make sense to say it was immoral, you know, for them to do this act of genocide. By definition, if the whole society or the majority entered in, you would have to say, well, it makes sense to call that moral. But the fact that a large number of people feel a certain way does not, or should not, rationally convince anybody that that feeling about the goodness or evil of something is correct. Ethics doesn't reduce to statistics, after all. Notice something else about societal subjectivism, often called cultural relativism. Cultural relativism says what's good or evil is relative to the society in which you live, or the culture out of which the ethical judgments arise. And that is, I can't say for sure, but as far as I have experienced it, the most popular theory of ethics on college campuses. Most people would say, oh yeah, ethics is relative to whatever culture you come out of. But the strange thing is, if you're a philosopher and you look at that, cultural relativism renders all social reform evil by definition. You ever thought about that? The downside is, if ethics is determined by each culture, then any attempt to change that culture, by definition, is a violation of the standard of ethics. So cultural relativism brings the absurd conclusion that any attempt, say Martin Luther King Jr., to reform society is, by definition, evil. That doesn't look like, philosophically, a very sound way to go with ethics. Ordinarily, people think of the goodness of something as evoking their approval, rather than their approval or their society's approval constituting its goodness. There's a big difference. And if I say, well, this is good, and that's what makes my society respond to it with approval, that makes sense. But to say the goodness just is that approval, I don't think will wash. Even atheists talk and act as though there are personal traits, actions, or things which possess the property of goodness, irrespective of the attitudes or beliefs of people in the society. Of course, there's even further problems with taking good to be whatever evokes the approval of the individual rather than the public at large, private subjectivism. Private subjectivism absurdly implies that no two individuals can make identical ethical judgments. That's not obvious on the surface, but analyze it for a minute. If good means evokes the approval of the speaker, the word good means evokes the approval of the speaker, then it's impossible for any two speakers to ever make the same moral judgment. When Bill says, helping orphans is good, he's not saying the same thing when Ted says helping orphans is good. Because when Bill says it, that means helping orphans evokes Bill's approval. When Ted says it, it means helping orphans evokes Ted's approval, which are quite different matters, logically. It would be impossible to ever make the same moral judgment if you were a private subjectivist. Not only would that view make it impossible for two people to make identical ethical judgments, it would likewise and absurdly imply that a person's own ethical judgments could never be mistaken unless he happened to misunderstand his own feelings that day. We all know what it is to hold a view and then to correct it later and say, I was wrong about that. But if you're a private subjectivist, the person could never, by definition, be wrong. Because what he says is good, meaning evokes his approval, does evoke his approval. So let's try another approach here. Intuitionism would suggest that goodness is an indefinable property, a basic or a simple property, which we do not come to know empirically or through nature. That is, we don't go out and use our senses and study the world and do research and draw conclusions and find out what good is. Rather, goodness is something indefinable and simple, and that we know, therefore, intuitively. But now we have to ask, if we're going to be philosophically alert, what does someone mean by a non-natural property? unless we're speaking of a supernatural property, which of course is the very thing atheists dispute. When an atheist says, well, goodness is a non-natural property, that just sounds like a linguistic way of not having to admit that it's a supernatural property. Moreover, intuitionism cannot provide a basis for knowing that our intuitions are correct. For you see, not only must we intuit the goodness, say, of charity, helping the poor, we have to also intuit the correctness of that intuition. So I intuit that charity is good, but I also intuit that that previous intuition is correct. It's a well-known and embarrassing fact that not all people and not even all cultures have identical intuitions about good and evil. And so these conflicting intuitions cannot be rationally and objectively resolved within the atheist worldview if you're an intuitionist. Similar difficulties attend the notion that ethical terms do not function and are not used to describe anything at all. That is, when we speak ethically, when we're talking in moral discourse, we're not even trying to describe anything. We're not using language in an informative way, but rather we're simply giving expression to our own emotions. This is what's known as emotivism, that ethical language is not cognitive and informative, it is rather expressive. So that when I say adultery is immoral, essentially I'm saying adultery, boo, I'm against that. I'm expressing my disapprobation when I use ethical language. But then again, on the emotivist theory, there can be no rational disagreement in ethics, and that seems absurd. According to emotivism, when people talk about ethics, they can never disagree with each other because all they're doing is expressing their emotions. And there's no contradiction about you express this and I express that. If we're not describing anything, then it's not even possible to disagree with each other, much less to rationally resolve the disagreement we have. The related performative theory of ethical language that's known as prescriptivism holds that moral utterances don't function to describe things as good or evil, but rather than seeing ethical language as expressive, which is what we just looked at, the prescriptivist says the function of ethical language is, in fact, imperatival. Whenever I'm speaking ethically, it's just a way of using language to try to direct other people to live their lives, to behave in a certain way, or to feel in a certain way. And thus, on this theory, no attitude and no action is good or evil in itself, and one is left without any explanation as to why people go around gratuitously directing other people with these veiled commands in the form of ethical discourse. Why do they veil the imperative force and the intention of their words with descriptive and analytical discourse and dialogue? I mean, it just doesn't make any sense. It's also true that not all ethical discourse is, as a matter of fact, an attempt to direct other people as to live their lives. How about hedonism? Hedonism tells us that the ultimate good is pleasure. That what's good or evil is what gives rise to pleasure or what is conducive to pain. Hedonism doesn't require a whole lot of discussion, especially when you realize that the theory of hedonism is actually the ethics of the Marquis de Sade, isn't it? If good or evil is defined by pleasure, then, of course, what the Marquis de Sade did in his sadistic treatment of women, which gave him great pleasure, apparently, was therefore good. But most people would take that as a standard example of what is not living in an ethical way. So I'm not going to pause with hedonism very long. Now, the atheist might turn, then, to an instrumental or a consequential understanding of what constitutes objective goodness. For instance, an action or a trait is thought to be good if it tends to achieve a certain end, like the greatest happiness for the greatest number. It's what we call utilitarianism. Now, the irrelevance of such a notion for making ethical determinations is that in order for you to be a utilitarian upon analysis, you would need to be able to rate and compare happiness, as well as be able to calculate all of the consequences of any given action or trait. You see, it's one thing to spew that out as a philosophical theory. It's been fairly popular in the 20th century. People say, well, what is good is what tends to promote the greatest good for the greatest number. And good here is understood to mean happiness. But then how do you rate happiness? In fact, it's pretty difficult for you to rate happiness within yourself. You know, would you rather watch TV for the next half hour or have a piece of chocolate cake? The happiness between these two is hard to compare even within ourselves, and it's all the more complicated when I have to rate watching TV and failing tomorrow's quiz. Now, there's some pain, there's some pleasure, but now what if I watch TV and have the chocolate cake and fail the quiz? Is that enough pleasure to outweigh the pain? I mean, how do you make these judgments? I mean, nobody has answered that kind of thing. I think it's impossible to answer, but no one has done so, or given us a calculus. But the problem is, it's worse than that. The utilitarian theory would require us to rate not just my own internal happinesses and pains compared to each other, but my happinesses and pains compared to your happinesses and pains. Think about that. You know, how do I rate... let's say that I steal your can of Coke. Just take a real minor thing. You know, you look away at lunch and I've taken your can of Coke. Now, I'm really happy. I was quite thirsty. And you're, in a minor way, inconvenient. You say, I wanted that Coke. Too bad. Now, how do I know? How do I rate the happiness? I mean, there's just no meter for that. It's not like you say, hey, call the ethics technicians out here. I'm going to, you know, plug me in here. Here's how much happiness I got. Here's how much pain he got. Oh, now we see how they relate. But see, the problem is, it's not just me and you we have to start doing this. On utilitarianism, we have to rate the happiness of everybody in our society. Or actually, if you're going to be fair, everybody in the world. Actually, everybody in the world now and shall forevermore live. If you're going to look at consequences, you can't arbitrarily say only some consequences will be considered. Because then you're being short-sighted, prejudicial, partial, and probably manipulative. Because you know what happens. How do you think supermarket chains, you know, do their rating of things when they say, hey, we've got better prices than the guy over here? You know, have you ever wondered what things they go in to compare? Well, they are obviously going to, in a prejudicial or partial way, favor these kinds of groceries over against those so that they know the outcome is going to be that way. And that's what happens if you say, oh, no, you don't have to look at all. Just do a random, quote-unquote, random sampling. It doesn't work that way. And so utilitarianism is just not a workable theory of ethics. It's simply impossible for finite minds, even with the help of computers, to do the rating that we're talking about. I mean, utilitarianism amounts to ethics by fairy tales, because no utilitarian, and this is an area where Dr. Bronson at least has some expertise, if you haven't studied ethics or philosophy, you may wonder, but no utilitarian has ever published the calculus for how to do this. You'd have to have an omniscient mind in order to do utilitarianism, but of course, atheism rules out the possibility of an omniscient mind, so there that goes. By the way, in terms of utilitarianism, I don't want to take too long in each one of these, we also have any number of counterintuitive counterexamples to utilitarianism. Let me give you one. Let's imagine that a certain community is really alarmed and upset because of a serial rapist that has been active over, what should we say, 2 or 3 years. The police seem to have been helpless to do anything about it. But it also seems to be the case that the series of rapes have stopped. At least the police have that confidence, but the community is still up in arms. And so in order for the police to regain the confidence of the community and to give peace of mind to people, the police take some loner, some guy that no one likes, has no relatives, maybe has bad BO, and says, he's the guilty party. And then they, you know, they rig the evidence and they take him to court and they convict him and punish him in whatever way is appropriate. And now the community is much happier. Everyone's trusting the police. We're working harmoniously and so forth. Now, I dare say most of us would say, even though The greatest happiness for the greatest number was accomplished by doing that, but that was an evil thing to do. And yet utilitarianism could, in theory, justify doing something of that nature. You can work on a more precise illustration later if you'd like. But I think the most devastating observation that can be made is this. On the utilitarian theory, or actually on any consequentialist theory of ethics, any instrumental theory that says good is what contributes to the following, the greatest good or the greatest happiness or the greatest number, whatever it may be. The most devastating thing to be said about that is that good may be taken to promote general happiness only if it is antecedently the case that generalized happiness is itself good. See, somebody says, it's good for you to do the following. Pardon me, or you ought to do the following. And I say, why is that? How do you define ought or good? Well, you ought to do the following because doing that will promote maximum happiness in your society. But what's the natural question to ask? I mean, if you're not just being somebody who's spoon-fed. So say, well, why am I under obligation to pursue the maximum happiness of society? And the answer must be eventually, well, because it's good to do so. All instrumental theories of ethics eventually run into that problem. Good cannot be instrumental until you first understand instrumental to what good is. You have to have some intrinsic goodness. You have to know that the goal ought to be the thing we pursue. Well, let's look at two more real quick ones. Rational deontologists. You'll like that because you use that terminology so often, right? You go to McDonald's and say, I'll have some deontological fries today. I realize you don't, but this is the terminology that you run into if you study ethics. A deontological theory of ethics puts emphasis upon duties and rules, right? And by rational deontological ethics, I mean a theory of ethics that determines our duties and rules by the use of reason of some sort. Immanuel Kant is a standard example of this approach to ethics. Kant formulated the view of the categorical imperative as a way of determining, you know, what the good will do, what the duty that's upon the good will is. It's a categorical duty. It's a categorical imperative. And one finds the categorical imperative by testing it according to the test of universalizability. If you can take a proposed line of behavior and universalize it, what if everybody did the following, then it is a categorical imperative rather than a conditioned one. Let me say just two things about the categorical imperative. First of all, any categorical imperative test can be cleverly skirted. How's that? Well, Kant would have said, if everybody's allowed to lie, then there's controversy as to what kind of absurdity is committed, a practical or a rational absurdity. But nevertheless, Kant said, you can't accept the rule, I can tell a lie, because you can't accept the rule, everybody is permitted to tell lies. All right, but how about this? Rather than the rule, I can tell a lie, let's test the rule, everyone with the following set of fingerprints, and then whatever the technical way of describing or showing the fingerprints is given as the identification. And I'm going to use my fingerprints. Okay, so everyone with these fingerprints may tell a lie. Now, what if we universalized that proposition? How many people would it cover? Well, it turns out both the singular and the universal version of that proposition cover only one person. And so now it turns out, if I word it that way, I can pass the categorical imperative. Now, any of you who study philosophy are sitting there thinking, now wait a minute, you know Kant's not going to sit still for that. Oh, I know he's not. Because you know what Kant or the disciples of Kant actually would say to that? They'd say, wait a minute, fingerprints are not morally relevant. You can't build that into your illustration. Only one problem. If you already know what is morally right or wrong, therefore what's morally relevant, you don't need the categorical imperative to test it. So much for rational deontologism. It turns out Kant did not give us a source of ethical rules. Even the Kantians know that. He only gave us a test Once you come up with some specimens that you want to test, Kant may have had something to help us with. I'm not going to say whether he did or not. But the point is, he didn't do anything more than that. He didn't tell us what the source. How do we know what the proper rules are that should be tested? And then finally, existentialism. Although this has lost a great deal of popularity in the last 20 years or so, it is in the first part of the century a very popular theory of ethics. And perhaps the best spokesman for it was Jean-Paul Sartre. I can't give a lecture on existentialism tonight, but to be brief, Sartre says in his writings that people must be authentic and not fall into bad faith. That Sartre tells you, be authentic, be yourself. Don't let anybody define you. Your essence is subject to your radically free will. You determine what you will be, what's right or wrong for you. Not the school teacher, not the priest, not the policeman, not the parent, on and on and on. And whenever we start thinking, well, I'm subject to some other authority or control, so I'm not really free, we're not being authentic, we're falling into the self-deception that I have other authorities over me or other controls in my life. I'm living in bad faith. And so here's Sartre's existentialist ethic. You exist. And now you determine freely your essence. It comes down to this command. Don't let anybody give you commandments. Anybody find a problem with that? You see, Sartre himself is telling us, live subject to my conception of ethics. If you're going to be, and I want you to be radically free, so don't listen to what anybody says. Well, of course, the answer is, well, then I shouldn't listen to what you say, right? Sartre's very attempt to advance his ethical theory is a violation of his ethical theory. Moreover, on the existentialist approach, it turns out that any, and believe me, any free choice in theory is equally authentic. Sartre says it doesn't make any difference whether you do this or that. The important thing is that you freely choose to do this or that. You can imagine that, you know, as a defense in a court of law, can't you? Here's a person sitting down, you know, and he has this accusation brought against him that he ran over that little child in the street and did it purposely because he was in a hurry to get to the movie theater on time. And the defense is, what I did was the moral thing to do. The judge says, what? How can you consider that moral? Is this because I freely chose to? Is it that isn't what we mean by morality? Sartre was just going so far down the line with his own preconceptions about free will and its importance that he lost touch with, I think, reality. Any free choice is not equally good with any other free choice as long as it's truly free. On such an ethical system, nothing proves to be really required or ruled out. And so, philosophically speaking, it turns out that the cogent atheist must be able to show that his judgments about good and evil are meaningful, and yet none of the available theories allow for the meaningfulness, the sensibleness of just the statement that this is good or evil, you ought to do this, you're prohibited to do that. The atheist worldview is unable to make sense of ethics. And that leads me to the second thing in my agenda tonight. I'd like to rehearse for you some commonly recognized features and preconditions of ethics. I think if you just read the history of ethics, or if you analyze ordinary discourse, you know, just read the sorts of things people say and listen to the way they talk. In ordinary discourse about ethics and what we've done in standard ways through history, I trust no one will find any objection to the following six. Again, if it was a whole course, I'd give you quite a few more of it. Let me just throw out six commonly recognized features of ethics or preconditions of ethics. When we use ethical discourse, first of all, we're speaking prescriptively, not descriptively. That is, ethics talks about what ought to take place, not simply what is the case. Ethics, the language of ethics is the language of ought, not the language of is, not the language of describes this to be the case. Secondly, Everybody speaks as though ethics is to be individually regulative. The emphasis here is upon regulative. That whatever ethics is, it's supposed to regulate the individual. Ethics doesn't change with personal desires and feelings, as though you ought to do whatever you end up doing, no matter what it is. The whole point of ethics is to say some of the things you do or want to do, you shouldn't do. It has a regulative, individual, regulative function. Thirdly, from the ethical point of view, virtue is not identical with personal pleasure and success. To use the jargon more popular today, doing good is not the same as doing well. Plenty of people have done well in this world. They've gotten ahead, they have big cars, nice big mansions, boat, and so forth, and we wouldn't say, therefore, they are good people. There's a difference between virtue and success. Again, I'm not saying this is like my Christian prejudice. It seems to me most people take that kind of thing for granted. There's a difference between those two concepts. Fourthly, in the ethical point of view, might is not identical with right. Okay? How do we know that a certain nation was in the right ethically? Somebody says, well, because their army beat the crud out of the other army. We'd say, well, maybe they did, but that's not an ethical observation. That's not relevant to ethics. Because ethics, the question of right and wrong, is not a question of who has the power. And that might, of course, comes in different expressions. It might be physical might, it might be economic might, it might be statistical might. You know, somebody says, hey, I'm right because the survey shows most people agree with me. Most people say, no, you don't understand the nature of ethics. Might is one thing, right is another. A fifth thing that's a precondition of ethics is free will. It absolutely is senseless to say somebody's under obligation when they have no choice in the matter anyway. You know? So when we speak ethically, we are assuming people can do this, they can do that, they can do the other, and they ought to do, and ought not to do, certain of these things. But if people don't make choices, then there's really no discussion of ethics called for. And then finally, ethics deals with universal obligatory authority. Another way of putting this is that ethical maxims are universalizable. That is to say, if it's an ethical duty for you, it's an ethical duty for everyone under similar circumstances. I mean, I have an ethical duty as a father to take care of my children, but not everyone has an obligation to take care of children, those who aren't married, those who don't have children there. But everyone in similar circumstances has the same duty. This is just another way of saying ethics plays no favors. Okay? It's not as though some people under these circumstances have these obligations, but ethically we can say other people under the same circumstances don't have those obligations. That just is not a feature of ethics. Now take those six, I really do believe, non-controversial, commonly recognized features and preconditions of ethics. And let's ask whether the atheist worldview comports with them. Does the atheist presuppositions about reality and knowledge, do they fit into just these six items that we have talked about? Well, what does the atheist believe about the world? I'll give you five quick examples, and then I'm going to show you the conflict between the six things I've just talked about, the five I'm now going to talk about, and then I would like to hear what you would like to say in response to the questions you'd have for me. First of all, the atheist worldview holds that the world is matter in motion. Of course, the atheist doesn't know where matter came from. That's inexplicable. And he doesn't understand where motion came from. That's inexplicable. But that's for another debate. The point is, the atheist thinks the world is matter and motion. Secondly, that man is a product purely of nature. You should notice here the illicit personification of what goes on in the world around us by calling it nature. All sorts of things have been packed in without you recognizing that. A sense of order, a sense of development, maybe a purpose, maybe even harmony and progress, all depending on whose view of nature you're using. But again, that's for another debate. Atheists would say, whatever man is, he's a product, purely a product of nature. C, or thirdly, depending on how you're doing this in your notes, all knowing is observational. That is to say, for the atheist, since everything's matter in motion, then if I know anything, it has to be on the basis of observation. And yet that's a self-contradictory theory of knowledge. If all knowledge is observational, then we can't possibly know the premise that all knowledge is observational, because that's not something you see with your senses or taste with your tongue and so forth. But again, that's for another debate. I think atheism's got all kinds of philosophical problems, but let's just be fair and describe it. Atheism says the world is matter in motion, man's a product of nature, all knowing is observational. D, or fourth, behavior is a matter of stimulus and response. In another debate, I would be glad to ask, where did responsiveness come from? You start putting grains of sand together, just to take a real amateur philosophical example, and you start wondering, how many grains of sand and what configuration do you have to put them together before the sand starts being, responsive to what you're doing to it? One has to wonder, not only where does nature come from, but where does responsiveness come from in these atoms that are in motion? And that's one of the areas of my special study, and I'd love to go into it. But let's just accept on face value that whatever behavior is, it's a matter of stimulus and response. And then fifthly, or E, in my outline, on the atheist worldview, all quality reduces to quantity. And that's the simplistic or pedestrian way of saying that everything that has qualitative everything that has a qualitative nature to it in our language really reduces to matter, mathematics, and configuration. Okay. So here we have the atheist worldview. And we also have six examples of commonly recognized features of ethics. And my point is, I don't see philosophically how you can harmonize these two. I throw this out to you. It just seems to me that what atheism holds to in its theory of reality and knowledge does not comport to what we hold to when we talk about ethics. First of all, I said ethics is prescriptive, not descriptive. But on the atheist view, the world is matter in motion. All quality, prescription, reduces to quantity, description. And all knowing is observation. But you see, no one has ever seen an ought in this world. No one has ever seen a prescription. We may have heard the utterance of a prescription, but no one sees ethical obligations. You can lose your key. Some of you have probably done that. But you've never heard anybody say they're going to leave your house, where did I put my ethical obligations? They aren't that kind of thing. And yet, atheists tell us that's all that exists, and then they want to talk about ought. And I'm saying ethics doesn't comport with that. Secondly, we said that there's universal obligatory authority when we deal with ethics. But again, if everything is matter in motion, if all that we know is based on observation, then the only thing that exists in the atheist philosophy are what we call concrete particulars. There's nothing abstract, there's nothing universal. There's just this, 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 this. There's never whatness or nature or universality or abstract things in the atheist worldview. Consequently, the very thing we're talking about in ethics, universal obligation, cannot exist in the atheist worldview that says only particulars, never universal, exist. Beyond that, we said that ethics is to be individually regulative. But with the loss of prescriptiveness and the loss of universal obligation, then there is no individual regulation within the atheist worldview. So we've lost the first, the sixth, and now the second of the six features I gave you. The fifth feature that I gave you of ethics was free will. But again, if nothing exists but matter in motion, subject therefore to the laws of physics and other laws, biology, etc., If nothing exists except matter in motion, and if man is nothing but a product of nature, so he's nothing but matter in motion in whatever complicated configurations you want to talk about, and if all behavior is stimulus response, then it turns out men don't really have free will. Whatever they do is just, I know it's very complicated, especially for us at this point of our scientific study, to lay out how all this happens. But the theory goes like this. Whatever you do is predictable if we knew all of the factors, if we knew all the stimulus and all the response mechanisms that have been built up in you. What you appear to freely do is really a predictable thing. And if all behavior is stimulus response, then it turns out men don't really have free will. Whatever they do is just, I know it's very complicated, especially for us at this point of our scientific study, to lay out how all this happens. But the theory goes like this. Whatever you do is predictable if we knew all of the factors, if we knew all the stimulus and all the response mechanisms that have been built up in you. What you appear to freely do is really a predictable thing, because you're just following, I'm going to be an amateur here, pedestrian, the laws of physics and biology and so forth that have influenced your bodily behavior. And so if free will has been taken away on the atheist worldview, then again, it's impossible to engage in ethics. Moreover, no individual is under authority to accept what another individual chooses as morally correct on the atheist worldview. Or no individual, I mean, any individual may not submit to the method that the other individual used for determining right and wrong. When I get into discussions, and I have quite a few, you know, with atheist friends and colleagues and that sort of thing, they'll often try to determine, you know, that this is right or this is wrong and do a utilitarian analysis on it. But you see, on their worldview, even if they were right, I don't think they are because they can't do the calculus, but even if they are right, they could prove that the greatest good or the greatest happiness for the greatest number would be performed if we didn't persecute homosexuals or something. You see, the comeback is, why should I accept that I should do whatever's the greatest happiness of the greatest number? I don't accept your method of doing ethics. And in the atheist worldview, everybody has the right, no one has any more authority over the life of another individual than anybody else. We're all just, again, bags of chemicals subject to the laws of physics anyway. And so atheism not only destroys features 1, 2, 5, and 6 of the 6 I gave you, it thus logically leaves the door open to reject 3 and 4 as well. 3 was the idea that virtue is not the same as success. Doing good is not the same as doing well. Hey, but in an atheist universe, if you give up those other features, maybe doing well is the most important thing. And the most ethical people around us are those people who just walk on others and get ahead. In the atheist universe, the door is logically left open to the idea that might does make right. And so the thesis that I'm sharing with you now for your discussion is that the presuppositions of atheism do not rationally comport with ethics. The atheist cannot make sense of even obvious moral truths like to the Somali warlord soldier, it is immoral for you to torture this child so as to extort her parents' precious little food. What does it mean to say that? What does it assume to say that? And why is that Somali warlord soldier under any obligation to adopt your feelings, your desires, or your culture's feelings or desires, or even your method of determining what's right or wrong? And with that, I'd like to welcome you into the conversation. I've probably taken longer than I should have a bit here, but we'll open the floor now for questions, comments, whatever you would like. Okay.
I always have like a dilemma thing, like with free will and stuff. It's like if everybody, say, like, had neither bad inclinations nor good inclinations, but were given a free will and had, like, neutral inclinations, then it's like, if you chose bad or good, then it would just be due to chance. I have sort of a diagram thing there.
Well, I think you might want to stop and ask what it would mean to have neutral inclinations. I think, actually, that means no inclinations, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, if people don't have any inclinations, then the real question is, do they have the freedom to do the good or the evil? Or is their behavior determined by antecedent factors like their social conditioning, their biological response mechanisms, and things of that nature? If they don't have free will, I mean, if that is your approach, it seems to me, I'm open to be corrected here, but I'm willing to debate it at this point. It seems to me if you don't have free will, it makes no sense to talk about ethics. There's no ought involved when you just do whatever you do.
Have you heard of R.C. Sproul?
Yes, I know him personally.
Oh, dude. Because, like, what he was saying was sort of, he could put into words what I was trying to say, that the issue of free will is a mystery that's, like, given by God, and that we
right.
can't totally explain it, but we could just trust that God has given it to us.
Right. And Sproul and others who are in that theological tradition, I share that tradition as well. When they talk about free will and God giving free will and also God being control of all things, they're getting into a theological subject, predestination and freedom, which is really different from the subject we're on tonight about freedom and just the whole issue of oughtness, you know, in the atheist worldview. So maybe we'll move on back to this, and if we have more time, we'll come back.
He's probably a Calvinist, wasn't he?
Sproul is a Calvinist. I am too. Right here.
I was wondering if you could quickly go over the difference between private subjectivism and prescriptivism.
Okay, in the first place, prescriptivism is a theory about ethical language. That is, when we're talking about ethics, what is the function of that kind of talk? The prescriptivist says, we're not trying to inform anybody. Yeah, let's say you and I go get a Coke and we have a long discussion of, say, abortion, controversial ethical matter, okay? And as we're going back and forth, the prescriptivist says, I'm not really describing for you what's right or wrong, and you're not describing for me what's right or wrong. We're just trying to direct one another. I'm doing all this, and it's a veiled way of saying, don't have an abortion, or don't have your girlfriend have an abortion, or something like that. Whereas the private subjectivist says that when I say something is good, I am describing something, namely, I'm describing what evokes my approval. And so there is a difference as to what the language of ethics is performing at that point. Yes?
Yeah, I'm a physics major, and I'm taking quantum physics right now, and I know that the physicists sometimes become more philosophical at times.
Yeah, they should.
But I was wondering if you've heard any of the quantum physics arguments and how that relates to ethics. Let me give you an example. The uncertainty principle would render the behaviorism model a little bit different, I guess.
Yes.
And I was wondering if you had any thoughts on that.
Can you rephrase the question or repeat it as best to your ability so that
okay.
I
may botch it when I try to do
that,
but I'll make the effort. The question has to do with quantum physics, and particularly the indeterminacy principle, and how does that affect, you know, your interpretation of behaviorism as a model of human conduct? And what has been popular in the literature, but I think it's really, really bad philosophy, bogus thing, but it's nevertheless been rather popular, is the idea that the indeterminacy principle would indicate that we're not able, even though in theory everything is predictable because it's determined by antecedent forces, nevertheless, you are never able to determine, you're never able to tell, you can't cognitively find out what it's going to be because initiating conditions are going to affect the way in which you go about finding a result. So that Stephen Hawking, for instance, in his discussion of the universe and man's place and so forth, tries to rescue ethics in this way. And he says, you know, we can never find the location and the acceleration of the subatomic particles simultaneously, because the attempt to do one as an initiating condition always affects the other. Well, I mean, I don't know a whole lot about physics, that's not my area of expertise, but I do know a lot about logic. And I can tell you that that's logically irrelevant to the behaviorist theory, because all the indeterminacy principle would contribute, if it contributes this, I'm just going to accept it on face value. If it contributes anything, all that says is we never know what the behavior is going to be, but it's nevertheless determined behavior. And free will is not a matter of not knowing what the outcome is. It's a matter of whether I really have anything to do in producing it beyond the laws of physics and biology. So it's really ethically irrelevant in my analysis. Yes, sir?
So, you know, under societal subjectivism, of course, if the majority of the society objects to atheism, then atheism is
truly evil. If an atheist were to say, I'm a cultural relativist, and then I say, well, so happens you're propounding that in a fundamentalist culture where the vast majority of people believe not only in God, but the Christian God and the inerrancy of the Bible and all that sort of thing, and therefore your being an atheist is by definition immoral, my guess is he would change his societal subjectivism real quick. Most people, cultural relativism it plays well. I have to admit that. It's not hard to go on the lecture circuit and throw out the college audience's cultural relativism. And it's really warm and acceptable. That's what kids want to hear. But it's just not philosophically cogent. Because then you say, well, you see, the downside is then that Martin Luther King Jr. fighting a racist culture was fighting what was good by definition. Most people want to say, no, good is something that's above cultures and they must conform to it. That's the presupposition of social reform. But the minute you say that, you've lost your relativism.
A lot of that strikes me as from anthropology. The anthropologist doesn't want us to interfere with this particular society that he particularly wants to study. And the thought comes up that in the olden days, the colonialists saw the tribesmen as a cockroach to be exterminated, and now we're more enlightened and see them as a cockroach to be studied rather than exterminated.
Yeah, I think there's some legitimacy in that observation. It is not true. I think it's a noble ideal, and I grant that it was sincerely enunciated. But it's just not true that when people study society as a sociologist, that they do not affect or wish to affect the society. I mean, the standard illustration there would have been Margaret Mead's work with Samoan unmarried young ladies, and what she concluded about cultural relativism from that and so forth, and then years later, her own methods and her own interest in studying it were exposed as not being objective and neutral after all. And, of course, I don't think anybody can be completely objective and neutral. And so the problem is not that she had her own point of view and her own agenda, the problem is she didn't own up to it. Here.
If all actions are predetermined, but each individual lacks capability to know what his actions have been predetermined to do, then isn't there a subjective free will?
No. Well, what there is the illusion of free will.
Right.
You look at the situation and you think you're making a choice, but that's illusory.
But
I don't think... go ahead.
Isn't that illusion what's relevant for ethics? If Bob would never realize that what he's supposed to do... he has this illusion of free will, and he can decide whether he can choose to behave or not, then there seems to be an ethical question there.
No, yeah. What's relevant to ethics is not the illusion of free will. Let me see if I can try to put some feet on your theory before I knock it down. This would be saying something to the effect, the reason why free will is important to ethics is that if people don't have the idea that they're making choices, then they just won't care. They won't get, if you will, they won't make a committal about doing this or doing that. If they're convinced that what they're doing has nothing to do with themselves, then they won't get involved in ethics. So in a sense, persuading people to be interested in ethics calls for giving them the illusion you're making a choice here. Now, that would be a theory that you could explore, but I want you to understand that that has nothing to do with what I was saying earlier, that unless people actually make choices that go over and above the laws of physics and biology and all the rest, then it makes no sense to tell them you ought to or you ought not to do anything right or wrong. That the ethical, the game of ethics, you see, is ruled out when you say there are no choices. Then you can say, well, but the illusion of the game can be saved if we have the illusion of free will. Saying, well, that may or may not be true as a matter of psychology, but it's irrelevant to whether ethics is, upon final analysis, absurd, an illusion, or whether it's real. Way in the back, Todd.
What assures large part of development? One tends to see, I intend, one sees that when a pregnant female is about to give birth, a few other females follow her off away from the pond. Usually those females that accompany her will be close associates in the sense that they have behavioral ties to each other more than to other individuals. In other words, they associate with each other more than with the other dolphins in the pod. And this is quite common in dolphin behavior. When she is about to give birth, those other dolphins tend to keep away aggressive males as well as bring the newborn to the surface for air. Is this ethical behavior?
No.
Why not?
Well, in the first place, it has nothing to do with obligation. Secondly, it has nothing to do with free will. And in terms of, and again, I'm not speaking here as a Christian or any particular theory, just philosophically, what we mean by ethics is verbally qualified. I mean, we have to be able to verbalize, analyze, logically run the inferences and so forth. So when you ask, maybe the simplest way to answer your question is, I think most philosophers would say that what you're talking about there is comparing apples and oranges. When you ask whether it's ethics, no, it's really something altogether different in terms of what we take to be discussions of ethics. Nothing applies to dolphins in that way. Now, let me just finish one thing. Somebody might say, yes, but that kind of instinctive or habitual behavior that you see in dolphins is a model for explaining all of human behavior. And therefore, though it is not really what we talk about as ethics, in the end, ethics reduces to that. Okay, so this is a version of a reductionistic approach to ethics. And the difficulty with all reductionism is just what the title tells you. It reduces what you're talking about to something different than what it was.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I'm not completely sure if it is reducing to a reductionist argument. However, it's debatable whether it is a learned behavior or whether it is an instinctual behavior. To some extent, dolphins rear in isolation do not show this kind of behavior. As far as reducing ethics, and I didn't mean to use the term reducing ethics, but just for the sake of discussion, or the verbiage, if we reduce ethics to something that is verbally shared, experienced, etc., does that then mean that a person who is born deaf, dumb, and blind, and doesn't have the ability to communicate has no ethics?
No. What I wasn't talking about the individuals having to have verbal ability. It's not like if you don't have dolphin A and dolphin B talking, then they can't be doing ethics. What I meant is what we call ethics in general, not as individuals, but it's a matter that's verbally qualified. Ethics is something that is describable, something that's arguable, that you use logical inferences with respect to, that you can enunciate in terms of you ought to do the following commandments, if you will. Dolphins don't have commandments, as far as we know. Now, you see, somebody might, later discover things which would make it, that would not refute what I'm saying now, would actually fall into what I'm saying now. That if we actually discovered the language of dolphins, that's a whole another issue, and I'll just get myself in a lot of trouble if I open it up tonight. I have arguments about that one way or another, too. But let's say it happens that dolphins do have language and that it can be decoded, we can understand it, and it turns out that all these other dolphins are reminding everybody, you have an obligation, go help Jenny now, she's about ready to have a baby. Then, yeah, I'd say they're doing ethics, sure.
And that we're sure. Again, I also have problems with the concept of belt intelligence.
Okay.
However, if that is true, then that means they also have God, or equivalent God.
I missed part of that. If that were true?
If that were true, does that mean that they would also be counted as quote-unquote human? In a sense of dealing with the deity?
I really enjoy this question. I hope no one thinks we're wandering too far, although we're going to get into theology here, and I'll back out real quick. But you see, one of the things I would say as a theologian, not speaking here so much as a philosopher, is that one of the things that defines man as the image of God, this is, I'm doing scriptural exegesis, those of you who aren't Christians and don't believe the Bible, I'm just meandering. But from my perspective, God has revealed that He made us as His image. And I think a crucial part of that is linguistic ability. It's interesting to me, in the Bible, God is described in linguistic terms. Jesus comes into the world as called what? The Word of God. God is described in the Old Testament as a speaker. God calls the world into existence. He spoke His Word, and it was. The Holy Spirit is considered in Scripture the breath of God. So you have the speaker, the breath, and the word, and when man is made in the image of God, it's not surprising, therefore, that language is unique to man. But I'm not going to be so much a priori and say, therefore, dolphins just absolutely cannot, have language. I don't think they'll ever be found to have the advanced kind of language that we do. And I can give you some of the features of that language that are unique to human beings. No ethnologist can conflict that. Animals don't tell narratives, they don't tell jokes, on and on and on, whatever their communication pattern may be. But let's say somebody says, well, I want you to deal with my hypothesis, Dr. Morrison. What if we found dolphins are? We haven't picked it up yet, we haven't decoded it, but they are telling jokes and they are giving ethical commands and so forth. I would be probably forced, I don't think this is going to happen, but I'd probably be forced to say they're made in the image of God then. That's not my theological conviction, but if that were true, that would be remarkable, wouldn't it? But since we're all being hypothetical here, let's come back to the real world. Another question. Yes, sir.
Is morality and ethics synonymous?
Yes. Yeah. And in most parlance, to say that we're dealing with morality, we're dealing with ethics, is to say the same thing. It isn't impossible for somebody to say, well, when I talk about ethics, I mean social behavior. When I talk about morality, I mean individual character. But that would be a little artificial, at least as I know the literature. They're used synonymously.
Can atheists justify the existence of a constitution or a legal system?
Let me answer two ways. Because I do want to be fair to my atheist friends. They can justify the existence of constitutional democracy, let's say. If you mean by justify, offer some kind of rationale over against being arbitrary. So that an atheist might say, look, we've just found that if you have a constitutional order, then there's more fair play, there's a way of resolving things without resorting to violence. There are all these advantages. So for the consequences, we're going to have a happier society, that would justify a constitutional democracy. But that's what I would call, and I don't mean to be demeaning, but that's what I call limited or shallow analysis. Because what's the next question for the inquiring mind? Well, but are we under moral obligation to resolve our differences fairly and so that people are happy and we don't resort to violence? And once you start getting into that, what you find is, I have found most atheists tend to be, they just take it for granted. They'll say, well, we all want to avoid violence. I mean, that's the condition of an enlightened society. To which I, as a Christian, would say, I agree, we do. But you can't account for that rationally. I can. I'm not disagreeing with you that we should be at peace. Sometimes people think, when Dr. Bonson goes on a campus and he starts philosophically cross-examining atheism, that I necessarily don't agree with what the atheist is saying. Well, that isn't true. I agree with the atheist when he says we should have a constitutional democracy. But I'm pushing to see if he has a coherent worldview Can he make sense out of that? And when he gives me a short answer, I'm saying, okay, thanks, but I want the long answer now. Get deeper. Why should we avoid violence? Why shouldn't we have a warlord society? I'll give you, I think, to me, a classic example of the history of philosophy. How many of you know the name Thomas Hobbes? Just through me. Oh, good. Okay, so most people, I don't have to be long about this, writes the book Leviathan, which is following out of his materialistic conception of reality. The historical significance of Hobbes is that he lived in a day and age when generally people were Christian of some sort, you know, in Western Europe and England. And he was a real dynamic. He pushed hard his materialism. So he writes a political theory called Leviathan. Okay? And what Hobbes tells us is that in the state of nature, the way men are found apart from the intrusion of civilization and so forth, it's a dog-eat-dog, war-like world. And people don't like the fact that there may be a bigger bully on the block that's going to, you know, push them around, and everyone's property is always up for grabs when we have this fighting and bickering and animal-like behavior. And so he suggests that what people do is they make a social contract. They say, let's agree to have somebody act as the biggest bully to keep all the rest of us in line. Now, granted, Leviathan, the bully, when he does this, is going to take away some of my, you know, prerogatives. But what I have sacrificed is more than paid for, but now I have a better chance of peace and other people not beating me up and that sort of thing. Okay? And so here's a materialist saying, you need a strong state so that we won't live in the state of nature where we're always, you know, dog eat dog and chewing on each other. But you see, what he never did get around to explaining is, well, why shouldn't I just take the state of nature if that's my... You know, there are some people who play NFL football, and my guess is they'd say, I don't need Leviathan. I am Leviathan. No one's going to mess with me, so I don't care to be part of your democratic society. And what does he say to that? You see, might and right have been so blurred when you're a materialist that even though he comes up with a rationale for the state, in the end, somebody could say, yeah, but I don't particularly care for what the state's going to accomplish. And that isn't ethics. And that's, ethics is not just coming down to what people happen to desire. Ethics is a matter of obligation, or so it sounds. It'd be much easier, and I, you know, I should have said this at the beginning of tonight's lecture. Let me say it now. Although I would argue that everyone must do ethics ultimately, the point of tonight's lecture is not, well, you've got to do ethics, and so now you can't be an atheist. I mean, if I've made my point, or given some credibility to my thesis. Because somebody can always say, oh, I see what you're getting at. That's right. My atheism doesn't comport with ethics. So I guess I'll give up ethics. Because I'd rather not be ethical or make sense out of ethics than to have to worship God. Now, that's something people could do. I didn't come here tonight to twist anybody's arm and say, you've got to do ethics. But I did come here to say, if you talk about ethics, you really are moving out of atheism into some other kind of worldview. Some kind of theistic worldview. Right here and then back there.
Well, I've heard naturalism come up several times. And the Christian gets the basis for his moral code from the Bible. But atheism, since they do not believe in a deity, will derive their moral base from Darwin, Hegel, Nietzsche. And if they say, as the Nazis did, you have a moral obligation to further these concepts, isn't that following a moral, ethical code?
The question has to do, let's say you're a social Darwinist or a Nazi or something, and you are compelled to follow a certain lifestyle and set of rules and regulations. And the question is that not following a moral code? And the answer is no. It is following a code, but we would say it's following a social code, or if you will, a certain set of legal, and by legal we mean civil, commands. But again, there's a difference between what is legal and illegal, and what is moral and immoral. As an illustration, that again, I think even if you're not a Christian, you probably wouldn't differ with this as an illustration. I'm a Christian. I don't believe the state has any right to tell me whether I can gossip or not. And at this point, there are laws against slander, but I mean just, you know, petty gossip. There are no civil laws against petty gossip. And yet the teaching of the Bible and the example of our Lord Jesus Christ is very clear that gossip is wicked. Okay, so I would say, just as a conceptual illustration, here's something that is immoral and yet it is legal from the civil standpoint. And so once you draw that conceptual distinction, when you point out that we have a civil code, you are not automatically talking about a moral code. Most people would say, in fact, our civil codes ought to be evaluated according to the higher law of morality. Some cultures don't believe there's a higher law, and they tend to be totalitarian for that reason, because whatever the lawgiver says, the human authority, there's nothing to check it by or to reform it by. Go ahead.
But in the case of the Nazis, they said, since science has proven that these other races are inferior, you have the moral obligation to promote evolution and get rid of them.
Right.
It wasn't a law. It was you have a moral obligation.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is, upon analysis, that is not correct. That's first arbitrary and finally absurd, because there is no moral obligation to follow the eugenics program, even if evolution, I mean, it hasn't been, but let's buy the nastiness and the racism just as a condition of debate. Even if it's true that the Aryan race is superior to the Negroid race or Mongoloid race and so forth, that would not prove that I ought to wipe out the others and promote the one. You see, that's what's called the naturalistic fallacy, moving from what's true naturally to what ought to be the case. Somebody might say, well, since they're the inferior races, I morally ought to help them, not hurt them. I mean, how you resolve the disputes in other matters. The point is, you cannot morally move from an evolutionary claim, even if true, to a moral conclusion. Okay, up here.
You mentioned in answering a question in regards to dolphins, well, not yet, you mentioned bottom line morality as a component of linguistic communication. Does that mean that a deaf society then, or a society that could, has no means of linguistically communicating or a history of contact with one has no morality?
No, I'm glad you brought me back to that, because I started in and answering that, and we got off on other things, and I never completed the thought that I had there. When I say that morality is one of the background conditions of morality is linguistic behavior, I don't mean that the individuals who do ethics must themselves have actual verbalization ability, but they must have rational ability. And if you just think of reasoning as internal dialogue, that's a very simplistic view. Yeah, I don't need to be corrected on that. I know that it has to be refined, but for popular consumption, we can think that way. What I'm getting at is, if you had a group of humanoids, I'm going to change your illustration, and it turns out they do nothing linguistic. I don't mean having the ability actually with their tongues to vocalize, but there's no linguistic use of symbols in their head, I would say they don't do ethics. Okay? But the fact that you have a society of deaf people or mute people doesn't mean that they don't do ethics, because even though they may not be able to enunciate, they are still able to think about it. And ethics is something that can be formulated in linguistic symbolism. Yes, sir?
Didn't you say, or at least imply, that ethics always implied a standard outside the created order, that, or the material order, that the material order is always approximate to?
Ethics, I believe that upon analysis, our ethical discourse indicates that what we mean by right or wrong is cross-cultural, and therefore ethics is always, in the metaphorical sense, above cultures rather than a product of cultures. I'm not sure if I said, I think I would say, to take up your question, that ethics is also something that is outside the created order, namely the character of the Creator, and that whatever happens in the created order is to be evaluated by the condition of, not the condition, the nature of the Creator. Did you want to follow that up?
Well, I'm just concerned about the answer to the gentleman's question about the dolphin's behavior being ethical. Not only would the answer to that be no, but depending on your presuppositions in an atheistic world, it would be impossible.
Well, in an atheistic world, it's not just dolphins that don't have morality, humans don't either. That's what I've been arguing tonight. And so if humans don't, which is supposed to be the standard illustration of ethics, then an atheist convinced by my lecture would have to answer that question. Dolphins don't do ethics either. All of us are nothing more but conditioned responses, okay? Stimulus response mechanisms. And dolphins have their built up conditioning, and humans do as well.
Well, then ultimately, then to try to categorize them would just be nothing more than human projection.
It would be anthropomorphism, in a sense, putting on dolphins human traits because we see some similarities in behavior.
Right.
And of course, ethnological studies in general have been, you know, just reamed over and over again by scholars for that very thing. Trying to read animal behavior as a version of human behavior, or on the analogy of what we know from human behavior. And there are real scholarly problems with that, I agree.
So, upon that end, so morality, therefore, is then, you mentioned, is a product of, you must be able to rationalize or reason in some effect, and what you're saying is that reason is a product, must have some linguistic characteristics.
Yeah, to put it, again, I didn't come with the lecture on this subject. It came up because of this comparison. And some of you, I don't mind you focusing in on anything I say, but you're pushing on this more than what I was intending to lay out there. I was just saying that as a background assumption, when we deal with morality, also when we deal with auto mechanics, for that matter, when we deal with human things and behavior, we're talking about something that's going to be verbally or rationally qualified. And if you get, and then if you try to apply that to something that doesn't use language or reasoning, symbolic reasoning of any sort, you're just comparing apples and oranges. That's all I was trying to say. Well, we're almost out of time. Let me take one last question and then we'll be dismissed.
This is kind of coming off of last night's thing, but with regard to this, with the debate last night, because he kept really trying to hold God to a standard, a certain kind of morality that seemed to be even above God. I guess there was an implication there that he had some standard he was judging God by. And I was wondering if the inference there is what is right, what God says, and therefore it's right, or like if God said that murder was okay, does that make murder okay, or is murder just wrong, and God can't say that murder is right, or how does that...
Right. The question here is, if ethics depends upon the will of God, which the technical term for that is voluntarism, that is God's voluntary will is the standard of ethics, then wouldn't it be true that whatever God says is, you know, right, whatever he says is right, and if he says murder is okay, then murder becomes okay. And what has happened is, in the formulation of that question, it's not you that's done this. I mean, Plato did it long before you did. And throughout history, it's happened too. We move from one kind of question to another. the question of whether we know right and wrong from God's will should be answered, yes, we know right and wrong from God's will. That's different. I'm talking about how we learn what is right and wrong. That's a different question from what's the standard of right and wrong. Okay? The standard of right and wrong is not the will of God. I know many of you here are Christians and you're beginning to wonder, whoa, what's he saying up there? Let me be real clear about this. God's will, he reveals his will to us. But God's will is a reflection of his character. And therefore, though I must have his will expressed to know what is right or wrong, what he's expressing is himself. God, to put it in real simple terms for you, God says, here's what it's like, here's what it would be to be like me on the creaturely level. Don't murder. Don't commit adultery. Don't lie. Don't steal, etc., etc., etc. God is showing his character in human terms, and we know what that character is by means of his will being brought to us in Scripture, and I think through the natural order and other sorts of things. So now, when somebody says, oh, well then if God were to reveal, if his will were to be that murder is okay, would that make it okay? They're asking an absurd question. They don't realize that. But you see, what you'd have to say is, could God reveal that something's right contrary to his own character? And the answer is no. God's true to himself. He doesn't lie. He doesn't contradict himself. He doesn't change his mind about things. And so, why do we believe that murder is wrong? Well, my theory, and this is another lecture sometime, is that because God has revealed himself to mankind. We all know this. We're made in his image. We read it in his word and so forth. We know murder is wrong. And then when we ask, well, what if God were to say other than that? You're asking the heretical hypothetical. That is to say, what if God were not God? And I'm saying, no, if God were not God, then that wouldn't be the standard of ethics at all. So saying that I know right and wrong from the will of God does not commit me to the voluntaristic conclusion that God could just do willy-nilly whatever he wanted. God only does what is God-like. And, there's a whole other lecture built into that. I promise you that we would break at this point. I was allowed to make a few final remarks. We haven't done a whole lot of debating. I don't feel the need to do much summary here. What I have suggested to you tonight, and I hope you'll chew on it, reflect on it, talk about it more among yourselves, is that when you do an analysis of ethical language, looking at the major theories of ethics and so forth, atheism cannot make sense of what it means to say it's immoral to torture that girl to extort food from her parents. Atheism cannot make sense of it. Shallow sense, yes, you can say, well, that won't make people happy. Okay, but why should we make people happy? When you push deeper, it turns out that there is no theory of ethical language consistent with atheism that makes sense out of ethics. And then the second thing I said is there are certain common preconditions and features of ethics that, again, I didn't make this up because I'm a Christian. Anybody, wherever I studied, USC, all the stuff I've read, everybody would say these things. And then when you look at the atheist worldview, you can't bring what that worldview says and what the conditions of ethics are together. Which leads me to conclude, therefore, that morality does, in fact, depend upon God. Thank you very much for coming.